Dhamma for today is called the Dhamma that should be encouraged and established in new monks. Dhammas that should be impressed especially upon newcomers to the Buddha Sasana, those who have newly taken on the role of followers of the Buddha, specifically those who have ordained in the Buddha's teaching. But like the Buddha, like many of the Buddha's teachings, it can easily be adapted to, for example, those who come to a meditation center to do a meditation course. Those who have newly come to do a meditation course have certain things that they should focus on, more so than those who are experienced, who don't need to be reminded so much of these things or instructed on these things so frequently. Of course, most especially for new monks who have a lot of things to consider, a lot of new rules and practices and a whole new way of life to establish themselves in, what are the things that they should be reminded of as newcomers? And you could even extrapolate this to consider those who are newcomers to Buddhism in general, thinking specifically of those who perhaps watch some YouTube videos and consider to begin to practice meditation, like for example through the At Home course that we teach. People who start that course in the beginning, what are the things that they should focus on? I think it can easily be extrapolated, talking about those who come fresh to the teachings. It's more of a practical set of teachings than a deeply theoretical or the very core teachings that one comes to later on in one's practice. So these teachings are from the Panchaka Nipata of the Anguttara Nikaya, the Antaka Vinda Sutta. And the Buddha is said to have instructed Ananda in these teachings, saying to Ananda, these are the things that you should teach to new monks. So technically, this is not a teaching for newcomers. It's a teaching for those who are meant to instruct them. So it's a reminder for us what to give to new meditators, something very valuable and of interest to us as teachers or as those who have spent some time in the Buddha Sasana. And of course, for those of us who are newly ordained, it's important for us to be told about these things and reminded of what we should focus on. So the first is Patimokkha Saṅvara, which we've talked about in several different talks now. This is the guarding of the rules. And as I've said in many other times, the guarding of the rules is the very beginning of the cultivation of sila. It isn't sila in its greatest depth, but it is the beginning. This is like, and so for a newcomer, this is absolutely essential. Rules, in fact, are most important for those who are new to the practice of the teachings. Because, of course, those who have been following the teachings for a long time, the ideas and the principles behind the rules are second nature to them, let alone the actual following of the rules. So sometimes they might mistakenly break the rules, but because the principles are so ingrained in them, it's not such a danger. But for newcomers who have different ways of life and are accustomed to behaviors that are often inappropriate for one who has ordained or more generally for one who has come to take meditation practice, they're used to acting and behaving in certain ways that are not suitable and not conducive to the cultivation of the Buddha's teaching. And so rules are essential and invaluable for someone who is new to the teachings, not as a substitute for actual ethics or actual virtue, but as a means of directing one in the direction towards the cultivation of true virtue and true sila, and as a result, concentration and wisdom. They can be likened to a road sign or on a hiking trail. If you've ever gone hiking in the national parks, they will have markers every so often telling you, don't go here, don't go there. There'll be a marker that's saying, this is poison ivy. So for someone who is familiar with poison ivy, they don't need that marker. They've been through the forest enough and they can say, oh, that's poison ivy, I won't go there. But for a newcomer, they don't know any better. They say, why shouldn't I go that way? Oh, there's a sign that says that's poison ivy. Don't do this, don't do that. You know, all of these rules, for someone, it's important to understand rules are there for people who don't know better. And as a newcomer, in many ways, you don't know better. You can extrapolate this in an easy to understand way to talk about the eight precepts or the five precepts. So the eight precepts as well, many people don't understand why shouldn't I engage in entertainment or why shouldn't I eat in the evening is a very common one. I'm thinking, what's the point? Why shouldn't I just eat whenever I want? You know, when I'm hungry, I should eat. And of course, because hunger, as we begin to learn, is not just a product of the bodily needs. It's much more, for a newcomer, it's much more about craving and desire, which of course we're trying to curb. But even more simply in the five precepts, for someone who is new to Buddhism, they might not even know that killing is wrong. They might not have a sense that stealing or lying or sexual misconduct or drugs and alcohol are wrong. Some people come to the meditation or to the practice of the Buddha's teaching having engaged habitually in the use of psychedelic drugs or psychoactive narcotics. Marijuana, alcohol, people not thinking that these things are wrong, not understanding the need for a pure and a clear mind and for a freedom from the need to pacify one's mental conditions. Rather, the idea is, of course, to face them. So these kinds of things, rules are there for people who don't know any better. A person who has attained sotapanna, who has come to truly see the truth of the Buddha's teaching and see the truth of reality for themselves, come to let go and experience nibbana, even just for the first time, will never break the five precepts, not in the way that they're expressed by the Buddha. So there's no need precisely for the five precepts, but they will still follow them. They aren't needed as a reminder. And so this goes with all sorts of rules, most specifically for those for monks. Many of the monastic rules are very difficult to understand the need. And for a newcomer, they can seem superfluous, they can seem overly busy, overly complicated. And it's common in some places to see new monks giving up the rules from the very beginning, not having any interest in keeping them in certain places and cultures around the world where you see Buddhism develop. If you spend time in monasteries, you'll begin to see the general monastic level of keeping the rules has declined and is often not up to par, where they from the very get-go say, oh, I'll just focus on what's important, not understanding the benefit of these rules, which admittedly are not intrinsically valuable. So for example, not using money. I'd say it may seem like an obvious one, but it's not intrinsically valuable. Of course, we can all understand the potential dangers of money, but there's nothing unethical about using money. So a person who doesn't touch money is not any better ethically. And yet, for having spent time as a Buddhist monastic, if you spend time around people using money and then see the difference when people are not using money, the difference is quite stark, and the value of keeping the many precepts that are not intrinsically valuable but are utilitarian, of utilitarian value. So there's this difference between should ethics be universal or utilitarian, that the philosophers talk about these ideas, and I'm not, of course, an expert on their philosophies, but from a Buddhist perspective, there are these two aspects of ethics. There are things which are ethically intrinsically immoral, like killing and stealing and so on. And then there are things which are just practically utilitarian in value. Not using money is an incredibly utilitarian rule that we absolutely as monastics should keep, and of course meditators should keep it as well. And you'll see in some meditation centers that are more in an urban location, the meditators will frequently leave the monastery to go and buy the things that they crave, or relieve themselves of their burden of desire rather than facing it, rather than learning to let it go, and so on. There are so many rules of the monastic. So keeping the precepts is a very important thing to impress upon new monks. It's There are many rules that you won't understand, and as I said, even the five and the eight precepts are hard to understand for a newcomer. But absolutely, these rules are not arbitrary. They haven't grown up over the years. They are ancient, and they have stayed the same for a very specific reason, for a very important reason, that they are intrinsically valuable, that they are the words of the Buddha, and they are an important first step on our coming to understand the teachings, just as having markers on a hiking path are important for you to make sure you make it to the end of the path without getting lost or killed or something, or fall into a patch of poison ivy. The second thing that should be impressed upon newcomers is guarding the senses. Again, a very common topic that we've talked about many times, but for newcomers especially, because this teaching is the guarding of the senses, the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, is the very essence of our practice of mindfulness in a sense, right? Noting seeing, noting hearing, sati samvara, with mindfulness, guarding the senses, indriya samvara through sati, through mindfulness, is a core part of the practice, and that will never change. This is not a newcomer teaching, this is something that should be stressed for everyone. But for newcomers, there are more worldly means or worldly aspects to this, that it's not just with sati, it's with sila, in the sense of taking it as a rule of conduct. For example, guarding the eye by not looking. Now, guarding the eye by not looking is not mindfulness, it's not the answer, it's not the solution. But for a new monk or a newcomer in meditation, not looking is very valuable. When you look, you like, or you dislike, or you react, or you judge, or this or that, so many things come up. It's very difficult for you to even learn to be mindful when there's so many things going through your mind being processed, which are as a result of seeing so much. So for a new meditator, and even more stressed for a new monk, you should always be with downcast eyes, looking at what's only necessary, looking at what is relevant to your task at hand, rather than looking to see what others are doing, what's going on here, what's going on there. There are even rules about it. When a monk goes into the village, absolutely, when they go into an urban area, they should keep their eyes downcast. Don't go looking around, don't go distracted by the world around. And so the same goes for the other senses. Hearing, don't go out of your way to try to hear things. Of course, you can't close the ears, but and you shouldn't. For the benefit of mindfulness, you shouldn't take these too seriously. I know there are some meditators who try to wear earplugs, and it's not that valuable that you should stress the importance of not hearing things, because eventually you have to face these things, and going out of your way, you know, to block the ears to not hear anything is not the right practice. But don't go out of your way to try to hear this or hear that. Is valuable. Smelling, tasting. Tasting is another big one that you can say is important for new monks. Guarding with mindfulness absolutely is something that everyone should undertake, but for new monks, you can also guard your taste by not going for foods that would normally please you. For an advanced meditator, they would just take a little bit of everything, not be concerned about the food, maybe think about what is good for their health because they know that they can't eat certain things. That's allowed, that's not wrong. But certainly for a new meditator, they might think, oh, that's something I really enjoy. I will not have that because I know it's very difficult for me to be mindful when I eat this or eat that, yeah, that sort of thing. For feelings, try to not use too much luxury. For a newcomer, it can be a real danger if we use luxurious beds and seats. So guarding the senses in this way, for a newcomer, mostly is about guarding what you see and guarding what you eat. These are the two that I can think of that are very important for newcomers to be aware of, because it's where the defilements can most commonly arise, and there's something you can do about it. Don't look at it, and just be careful about what you eat so that you eat simple. Try to eat mixing the food up, you know, like a new monk should eat in their bowl, and so there's this value added to having a bowl and the fact that you can mix your food up and not have to be too concerned with the taste, the individual tastes. The third thing that should be impressed upon newcomers is bassa paryanta, the limitation of speech. Again, speech is something that naturally comes less for long-term meditators, but it's also something that an enlightened person doesn't, of course, have to worry about. They can speak. They will often give talks on the Dhamma. A person who has followed through with the teachings and has learned the teachings and has come to understand the difference between right speech and wrong speech should theoretically be able to talk without being concerned about the limits. And yet, one of the big lessons that an advanced meditator learns is talk less. You'll get in less trouble. But for a newcomer, this is not the case. We're used to talking a lot. For the most part, we're an engaging species. We communicate through speech much more than other animals. We communicate constantly through talking, through communication. Nowadays, it's not verbal speech, but it's texting or emailing or this sort of thing, you know, instant messaging, chatting. But all this sort of communication should be limited. And for a newcomer, it's important to limit, physically limit your communication. Remind yourself that you don't need to talk so much, because your habit from not being a monastic, not being a meditator, not being engaged in the practice of the Buddhist teaching, will be to talk a lot, to talk often, to talk about things. In fact, sometimes we feel obligated to talk. We might think, oh, if I don't say something, they'll think I'm unfriendly. And this can be a real problem for newcomers. They don't realize the importance of silence, and so they think, oh, someone just moved in next door, I should go and say hello and tell them my name. I often joke with the meditators is that they know each other better than I do. I often don't even know the names of my meditators, because the name isn't important. You come, I give you the teaching, and I remember your face, that's enough. But the meditators will be able to tell me the stories about each other, their backstories, in ways that I don't know. And the only way that could happen is if they were engaging in, well, useless speech, speech that was of no value or import, but often simply because, well, that's how you be friendly. We're not here to be friendly in that way. We're not here to engage in relationships with each other. We're here to learn about ourselves. And the only way we can do that is if we focus on ourselves. And it's essential for a new meditator. It's also essential for monks in general to not have a lifestyle of chatting, of communicating. If you look at the suttas, there's the case where a group of monks decided for 3 months of the wasa, the rain season, they were not going to speak at all. So for 3 months they went without speaking, and the Buddha asked them at the end, how did you spend the rains? They said, oh, we didn't speak. The Buddha scolded them. He said, that is not according to the Dhamma. He said, even animals can go 3 months without speaking. You are monks. And he was making a point that speech is important, right speech is important. And then there was a group of 3 monks who spent the 3 months of the rain together, and then the Buddha came to visit them and asked them, how are they spending the rains? And they said, we don't talk at all. When we need to have someone help, we use a hand gesture, but we will in no way break speech. But every 5 days, I think it was, they would get together and they would talk Dhamma. Recite the teachings, talk the teachings, but speak about the Dhamma together. So they would speak when it is important. And the Buddha praised that they would do their best to not speak unless it was absolutely necessary, but then to speak together in order to facilitate the teaching and the learning of the Dhamma. So this is what we do when we give talks, when we have discussion, when we have reporting. This is a valuable part of our practice, absolutely. Apart from that, there's a real obvious distinction between that and chatting and socializing, which should not be encouraged and for the most part should be avoided. You can be absolutely perfectly friendly without speech. It just takes a little bit of an adjustment. You smile, you express kindness, you give people their space that they need, and you give support, and you observe when people need help, and you help each other. But you can do all of this without speech or with minimal speech. In many cases, you can't expect to emulate these monks who didn't talk at all, but you know, speaking very briefly about what is needed, speaking briefly about a situation, and then going your way with a smile is absolutely perfectly friendly and incredibly valuable for reminding each other, for maintaining the emphasis and the dedication to the practice. So knowing having a limitation on our speech, because you know, useless speech is useless, but it's also absolutely a cause for great stress and mental proliferation, which leads to craving and liking and disliking and judging and just doubting and worrying and future and past and conceptual thinking. Instead of focusing on your experience, you're now focusing on that person and their ideas and the things they said and so on. You can see this as a meditator. You can see how this happens when you do make the mistake of having a conversation, chatting with someone else. It leads you out of the present moment and out of your practice. The fourth Dhamma to be taught impressed upon newcomers is called Kaya Vupakasa, which means physical or bodily seclusion. There are two kinds of seclusion in the Buddhist teaching, Kaya Vupakasa and Chitta Vupakasa, or Viveka it's sometimes called, but here the Buddha uses the word Kaya Vupakasa. So Chitta Viveka is something different. It's the cultivation of the jhanas, the cultivation of meditation practice, which secludes the mind from the experiences so that one is only focused on one's meditation object. In the practice of vipassana, it simply means the seclusion of oneself from the defilements. You don't actually seclude yourself from the experiences. You experience things filtered, pure, and free from the defilements. So seeing is just seeing, hearing is just hearing, as the Buddha explained to Bahiya. But Kaya Vupakasa is valuable all the time. And again, this is the sort of thing that becomes a habit for people who have practiced the Buddha's teaching over the long term. But again, for newcomers, seclusion is not something that they seek out. We often seek out communion. Many meditators will remark upon the lack of group meditation in our meditation centers. But to be honest, following the Buddha's teaching, there's no sense that we should be practicing meditation in a group. The benefit, the seeming benefit and the encouragement that it gives is really just a crutch and in many ways a hamper of our honest dedication to focusing on ourselves and our own experience. The support that it gives is the fact that you are thinking about the other people around you, which is not mindfulness at all. When you're thinking about how other people are perceiving you, and having it remind you to walk straight and to not do this and not do that is really getting yourself outside of your experience. So there's something quite valuable about the seclusion and the practice in complete seclusion, where all you have to think about and concern yourself is your own experience. And over time you will realize this, but in the beginning a meditator will often think that they need communion, they need community, they need other people. And it should be impressed upon them that this is not really according to the Buddha's teaching, where again and again the Buddha told us to find an empty place, a place where there is no one, not even other good people, where there is only you and your problems and your defilements and your progress to be free from the defilements and free from suffering. The Buddha again and again taught us seclusion of the body for the purpose of seclusion of the mind, that our minds should become pure and focused only on experience just as it is. The fifth Dhamma to be impressed upon new people is Sammāditti, right view. Again, in one sense, absolutely something that everyone, new or old, has to be concerned with. Right view is really the essence of the Buddha's teaching in some ways. The right view at its core means the understanding of the Four Noble Truths. And so this is absolutely what we're aiming for. Every moment of our practice is dedicated to the ultimate goal of seeing for ourselves the Four Noble Truths, which is the truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the path which leads to the cessation of suffering, as we've already gone through, of course. But for newcomers, to start with, it's important to impress upon the importance of right view. It's important to impress upon them that they may not have right view. It's important to understand as a newcomer that you are coming with your own views. You are coming from a lifestyle that was not monastic and may not have been according in line with the Buddha's teaching at all. So someone who is a newcomer to Buddhism should not try to interpret Buddhism through their own views. They should appreciate that they may have views that are not the views of the Buddha. And even though it may resonate with them, they may reinterpret the Buddha's teaching in a way that goes against the actual Buddha's teaching, the Buddha's intention in providing the teachings. So people will be caught up in greed, caught up in anger, caught up in delusion, and without realizing it, will fall back on habits and patterns which are based on defilement, which reinterpret the Buddha's teaching to water it down or to mix it with worldly ambitions and worldly goals or worldly attachments. Like the idea of getting caught up in the world, using the Buddha's teaching to fix the world in this way or that way, or fix one's life in a worldly sense. And so the first thing to be impressed is that it's important to spend time and to take as part of your practice and be open to the adjustment of views. But more in intrinsically, it has to be taught, or newcomers have to be taught right view as an important part of their practice. And in this sense, it means not the right view that they will eventually come to teach themselves. This doesn't mean you teach someone the Four Noble Truths and then they become enlightened through that teaching. That is something they have to realize for themselves, but it means that you teach people the right understanding of the Buddhist teaching, that we follow the right understanding of the Buddhist teaching, because again, we come to the Buddhist teaching with our own ideas, and if not given proper and detailed instruction, it's quite common for those who, especially those who have much learning, to again interpret the Buddhist teaching in their own way, and in a way that goes against the tradition. So it's often valuable for us to check our own interpretation against the interpretation of the established teachers, and this is what's very valuable about the Theravada. You can see if someone is going against the Theravada, then it's highly likely that they are just following their own interpretations, their own views. It's not so likely that they after all these hundreds and hundreds of years have found something that all of these other wise and venerable teachers missed, and that they're now only now able to be the one to interpret the Buddha's teachings correctly. I mean, it's certainly possible, but much more likely that they themselves are just following their own views, which are not based on the Buddha's teaching, because of course they don't come here having based anything on the Buddha's teaching. We come to the Buddha's teaching with all of our views and all of our ideas based on something else. And until we are given this sort of instruction and detailed explanations of the Buddha's teachings, it can be very, very easy for us to reinterpret them and thus follow a way that is, again, out of line with the Buddha's teaching and not likely going to lead us to the goal of the Buddha's teaching. So these five are incredibly important. They are not core, they are not deep teachings. They sort of skirt around the edges of the deeper aspects of the teachings, but they are a reminder to us that the Buddhist teaching is not just focusing on the point that will lead us to enlightenment. It's about looking where we are. We're at the bottom of the mountain, and we can't think about what we're going to do when we get to the summit. We have to think, look, at the bottom of the mountain, what are the first steps, and how do we deal with being at the bottom of the mountain? For a newcomer, there are many ways in which, no matter how great you are, and it's quite possible that someone has a sense that they are great, no matter how great you are, you may very well be great, there are going to be ways in which the Buddha's teaching is new to you. And it's important we understand that our practice of the Buddha's teaching will, by its very nature, teach us things that we do not yet know in any way, that are unfamiliar to us, and we are going to be surprised by them. It is going to be a real and deep change in the way we look at things. And if we can understand that, then we can be able to adapt ourselves. So maybe I could add something, is that a new monk should be, or a new meditator should be, open to instruction and open to change. And the Buddha has said this in other places, that though these are the teachings that one should impress upon new monks, it's the duty of new monks and new meditators to allow them to themselves to be instructed and to be able to follow the teachings. So these five are things that we impart, and I impart to you, and as you begin to teach others, you can impart to newcomers as well. These are the dhammas for one who is newly ordained. And that's the dhamma for today. Sadhu.